It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
Hey, got my funk on.
You loving that funk lead?
I do. It is the most popular intro in my house.
Well, we keep using it, so obviously we're liking it.
And, we're leaning towards the edgy side.
And maybe looking for some other versions of it, maybe?
Yeah, that's our little feeler app. Putting out there to all the audiophile people.
Yeah, some of you really.
Make some new funk things.
And we've always said there are some outtakes from our old podcast that would make some interesting.
Oh, don't go there.
Not sure we can
use
them.
Don't go there. That would be funny.
Heard some phrases that, boy, if you lifted them out of context, would sound pretty bizarre. Fortunately, when DJ did this one, they were pretty good phrases.
Thank you,
DJ.
I'm scared of your editing prowess.
We'll see where else that can lead. So what are you doing this week?
What am I doing this week? You know, I'm asking Jesus what I'm doing this week.
You haven't got it clear yet.
Oh, I got a bunch of things going on. I got irons in the fire, but there's always a sense of, hey, Lord, exactly what are you doing this week? And I usually try to follow him.
Do you?
He loses me every now and
then. How's that working for you?
He loses me every now and then. Like we play hide and seek, he wins.
He wins?
He wins.
Both the hiding and the seeking.
Usually I lose him, but he does find me. So it's all good in
so
the
it works.
End.
You guys play a reverse kind of hide and seek thing.
Yeah, it's not too dissimilar. You know, sometimes I think it's how I play hide and seek with Taylor. You know, she goes and she finds a hiding spot. I find her. And then she thinks that's a really good hiding spot, so she tells me to hide there, and then she'll come find me.
Perfect.
That's how I think hide and seek should be played, and especially if mere mortals are doing it with a supreme being, he really ought to make it easy for us to find him. And so I tend to try to find him in those kind of spots.
But we're not always bright enough to go back to the place where we last hid and see him there.
Rarely are we bright enough to do that.
That's what we're learning, I guess. Well, I'm off to Climates North.
Climates North. That would be Canada.
I'm headed in, well, not far into Canada. I'm actually going to Detroit and then going from there south into Canada.
You're going to get bacon, maple syrup, and cheap meds,
Well,
right?
Actually, no. I'm not going to do any of that, as I understand it. Maple syrup might be fine, but the rest of it's not going to happen. Actually going to hang out with a group of folks in Windsor, Canada that have a little messianic flavor, I guess. I haven't often hung out with people that have that particular part added to their Christian experience.
What is a messianic flavor?
You know, kind of following the Torah and doing all the stuff the Old Testament says was important.
Oh, some rich Jews.
And I don't know the Jews. I think they're just feeling like that's part of their Christian experience. They want to talk to me about it. So we're going to go have some fun.
You're an interesting guy to have.
So I may come back with a prayer shawl. Who knows?
And see, then that works for you.
From there, I'm headed back into Detroit to hang out with some brothers and sisters there on Sunday night and Monday, Memorial Day. And so this will actually already be airing after this week has happened, but we don't have time to make a podcast between now and then. So we're doubling up and making an extra one today.
Well, you can come back with your prayer shawl and do some chair dancing.
And then I might do it. And then from there, I'm going off to Iowa, where there's a school district fighting over a sexual orientation clause and their anti-harassment policy.
Oh, sounds like a lot of fun to do in Iowa.
Actually, I'm looking forward. I always enjoy the bridge builder opportunities and getting to hang out with folks that are wrestling with those kinds of issues. So that'll be fun.
Well, it's good.
Yeah. And then I'll be back on late on a Thursday, so this will air right after that. And maybe the next week we'll talk a little bit about what we did in Canada.
Are you got a funky article
could
on
be
your
fun.
Hands over there.
You know what? Christianity Today, excuse me, this is Time Magazine.
Oh, that's mainstream.
Surprise you once in a while. The essay in their May 15th edition, it's written by Andrew Sullivan, who claims to be a believer, and he says, the title is My Problem with Christianism, which is kind of a tough say. And the subtitle is A Believer Spells Out the Difference Between Faith and a Political Agenda. And I thought this was fascinating.
Uh-oh. We're going into troubled waters.
Not so much, more sacred cows to jump over, perhaps. But I, as I travel around and talk to Christians, particularly overseas Christians, I mean, they're really not thinking America is representing a Christian nation ideal philosophy at all in the rest of the world. And that's with a president who claims to have that part in his life. But I'm finding people are on this journey who are becoming increasingly troubled by being labeled a Christian. Not because they don't want to be known as a follower of Christ, but Christian is seeming less to mean a follower of Christ as it means that you're falling into a specific, I can't even say the word, a specific political agenda, or you're falling into some kind of religious activity that doesn't describe them. And so I thought, man, it'd be interesting to talk about this term Christian. Is it working? Is it working for you?
You know what? I don't really use it a whole lot, actually. Because to me, a little bit, it's like, you know, when someone says, oh, you're religious. I hated that.
Yeah,
it's
I don't
like
that
I would
either.
Usually recoil from that, like, nope. How dare you insult me like that? And I've
heard people say, I'm not religious, I'm a Christian. And then, now that no longer has much meaning.
Yeah, that used to work about a decade ago, but now there's a sense of, there's just a lot of baggage on the terminology, because at the end of the day, you're pretty quickly stereotyped as a member of the, you know, ultra-conservative right. I mean, I love the picture. You got this wonderful little
elephant
holding up this Catholic-looking cross that's beaming, white and blue, and it's kind of like, the statement right there.
Well, more disturbing than that is the quote from Tom DeLay. And for those of you overseas who don't know who Tom DeLay is, he's recently resigned his place in our Congress because of some ethical charges against him. And, I don't know if the charges are true or not. I do know he comes off like one of the things I really hate being typified as Christian, and that is he comes off as an extremely arrogant, manipulative personality. Here's a quote they have from him about this whole thing. He says, sides are being chosen, Tom DeLay recently told his supporters, and the future of man hangs in the balance. The enemies of virtue may be on the march, but they have not won. And if we put our trust in Christ, they never will. And I just go, man, see, when a guy like that is invoking Jesus for his political agenda, I'm thinking the whole thing is incredibly confused.
Oh, you don't want to just give money to the GOP?
I couldn't now, even if I wanted to. Sarah would hunt me down, have my hand on that one. So no, I just am. There is a political movement in America that claims it's not just the GOP. Not everybody in the Republican Party is going to claim to be Christian for sure, but a lot of conservative Christians, I think, looked at the president, the current president we have, and look at the Republican Party as being their savior for America. And that's overstated, but they're the ones that are going to bring Christian values. And yet the people pushing Christian values in terms of morality seem to demonstrate the values of love and compassion and humility not at all. And I think that's what turns my stomach. I didn't even think, when I was with folks in Ireland again this past trip, Sarah and I were there, and to hear wonderful Christians talk about America and the arrogance of our foreign policy that's been under this current president we have, I don't think a lot of Christians, if you don't travel outside the U.S., you don't have a sense of how out there we are perceived as the bully on the block with the cruise missiles that can blow you up. They're really worried we're going to launch them into Tehran tomorrow and get the Iranians now, because you know what? It's worked so well in Iraq. I just... And I, you know what? The whole political thing about terrorism and going to war and doing what you got to do, that's a whole nother discussion. What I struggle with is putting the name of Christ and the name Christian to those kinds of things that I just think are repugnant, and the arrogance of it and the lack of humility. If the believers that were first called Christians in Antioch were called Christians because they look like little Christs, people would be near them saying, man, this is who I would imagine Jesus to look like. I got to tell you, Tom DeLay doesn't fit the Jesus test for me at the moment.
No.
No, I'm sorry, he doesn't. And I don't know the man. He might in his personal life be an incredible, humble, he might even be listening to this podcast, which if he is, I'd love to talk to you. But in terms of his public persona, demonstrating the reality and compassion and humility of Christ is not there.
Well, yeah, it seems to me that there's a whole media spin of the culture wars that, unfortunately, there's a large percentage, or a percentage, I don't know how large, that falls into those stereotypes all too conveniently for them, because they do present themselves as kind of angry, demanding, judgmental. We're going to take back America. It's like, you know, Jesus does this by force.
And let's be clear, the left does this too. The left is as angry, as manipulative.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not saying that there's any more virtue on one side of this politically than another. I guess what my heart has been toward this is, as a person who knows Christ in the world, I don't want to be stereotyped by the way those terms are being used. Even when people ask me if I'm a Christian when I'm on an airplane.
How do you answer?
I find myself saying, you know what? I'm not comfortable with the way the term is being used. I am a follower of Christ, and I'm not apologetic about that. At the same time, what Christian has come to mean, you're supposed to treat gays in a certain way. You're supposed to treat morality in a certain way. You're supposed to have a certain political agenda. You're supposed to be in a clubhouse every Sunday morning at a given time. I don't fit those definitions, and I don't even try anymore, happily not to. But you know what? I don't think Jesus tried to fit all those either. I think what Jesus' character, when people in Antioch were called Christians, I think they looked like something that they imagined Jesus to be. If God were in the flesh, having compassion for broken lives. When he looked out at the multitudes, he didn't see sinners that gotta pass a law to make sure they stop sinning. He saw people harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. His heart broke for them. He wanted workers to go out there in the harvest and help people come to know who his Father is. I see that as very different. And what Andrew Sullivan in his column here suggests, he's suggesting we stop calling Christians those that have this political agenda. He thinks we should call them Christianists.
Uh-oh.
And then try and preserve the term Christian for something that gets back to its original meaning. You know, I've got to tell you, I think camel's nose is not only in the tent. I think the whole camel's in the tent, and you're not going to make that happen.
He plays off the reality that your average Muslim is not like an extremist terrorist Islamist. And so it's like Islamist.
If we use Islamist for the terrorists, we can use Christianists for the...
I wonder how you're going to finish that.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. I can already see my mom and dad going, what's he doing on this podcast?
They're still on your case, aren't
they? Yeah, every time we mention Bush, they just kind of freak. But because they really like the guy.
I do think it's a challenge because I don't think we're supposed to abdicate our capacity to be a voice within the governing affairs of our culture. I think we're supposed to play an active role in that. I do.
I agree with you, and I do all the time.
I just don't believe that the laws and the courts and the politics of the land is going to be our ultimate savior.
I also don't think the prophetic voice to a culture is a political voice. And I think trying to marry those two leads to some very awkward endings. I love when Jesus said to Pilate, I just read it the other day, and it's quoted here in the article, as a matter of fact, as well. When Pilate's asking him, you know, are you a king? And he says, my kingdom is not of this world. And if my kingdom were of this world, my followers would have swords. Or if my kingdom was of this world, my followers would have political action committees. You know, if he were saying it today. I do think there's a major difference between prophetic influence and speaking the truth to our culture about morality and integrity. It's another thing when you combine that into a political force that is as manipulative and as corrupt and as arrogant as the world is. Because then you don't have a line to draw. You know, Pilate's forces look exactly like, you know, the religious rights forces, quite honestly. And so you can't tell the difference. And it ends up putting Christ, people defining Christ in a way that is well beneath the king that I know and the older brother that I love. That's my problem with it.
Yeah, and I think that's unfortunate. I think one of the biggest challenges you have is, you know, just, you know, it's like Francis Schaeffer had the phrase, you know, how then shall we live? Well, you look at the dynamic. What is a follower of Christ? What does that look like to live in our culture, to be in the world, but not of the world? And how do you actively engage in influencing and making a difference? If that's what you know, it's like, I want to be a light and I got to turn my light on. I'm going to be salt and I want to have a preserving effect. You don't abandon those arenas, do you?
No, you don't abandon them, but I think you penetrate them as individuals, in my thought of it. You would penetrate those Republican and Democrat and Independent and Green Party or whatever it is that your issues are important about. You inhabit those as a Christian, having influence as a follower of Christ, doing what he gives you to do, not using Christ as the political platform on which you're going to build a mass following and even present the idea to the world that Christ has a conservative political agenda a la Tom DeLay, that he's on that side. And if you're not on that side, you're against Christ. I think the whole idea of that in the political environment just smacks of evil. Can I say it that way?
Oh, you just did.
Wicked in the sense of twisted. Wicca, like Wicca furniture, you know, that kind of thing.
You know, I think the whole dynamic is, you know, we want God to be on our side because we want to use the God card to muscle our agenda. And it's like, you know, when you go to God, it's like, whose side are you on? It's like, I am the side. I mean, God is, he isn't picking one or the other. You know, when Joshua, you know, before the battle, you know, sees the Lord and it's like, you know, who are you for us or for our enemies? And it's like, neither. You're like, oh, wait a minute, we have a whole different order here. I do think that it's a challenge to be able to quote, you know, dare I say, incarnate that, because I don't think any of us by ourselves does a great job of being able to reflect the fullness of who God is. And so when we try to bring that to the world and shape it, we're not real great.
No, we're not.
And I think when there's an impassioned desire to do that, it might have begun sincerely motivated, but most oftentimes it isn't relying on God's genuine presence and power to permeate and accomplish that willingly in hearts without the use of force. Most of our efforts as men is really to force someone into something godly, as if that by itself will be a good result.
Yeah, and as if we have the mandate to do that. And I think people who don't know God as Father and don't know Jesus in a relational way really do take on these mandates. You know, it's our responsibility. Someone looked at me recently. We were in discussion with a group of folks about people living outside the box, and one of the people in that discussion was a pastor of a Southern Baptist fellowship. And we're just talking about, you know, listening to God and doing what God says. And I remember this one, the pastor's wife just said, well, we already have our mandate from God, so we'll have to seek him every Sunday morning to know what we should be doing. And it was just kind of, it had all the arrogance of that kind of thought about God, that there's just these mandates that we follow, rather than there's a person that we're knowing who does know us and does lead us, and we can be involved with him in a daily way. It's like, no, we've already got mandates. And people I deal with bridge builders who got this mandate to take the country back for God, and you know, when you talk to them as individual people, I you don't get the sense that they have any idea who God is, bless their hearts, and well-motivated in the sense that they have this biblical conviction that they're going to play out in the political arena. And some are going to be duplicitous about it. Some are really to the point of the end justifies the means. It doesn't matter what we do to get there. We've got to get, you know, the gays back in the closet, and we've got to get immorality to stop, and we got to preserve the sanctity of marriage, and we got to. And it's just, it's this rabid agenda that really is exactly what you said. We're going to force the culture into these ethical stands and not giving them any hope that only through Christ is the gay person going to be transformed. Only through Christ is the sins that beset us going to be dismantled. And it's always this, particularly with the Republicans. And I am a Republican. I haven't changed my party affiliation. I still have much more in common with where the Republicans come from on a variety of issues than I do the Democrats. So I'm still in that party, though I'm less passionate about it. But I notice when they sketch out traditional values, I am with some on the who are left are saying, but you're very picky about those values. You're going to say, yeah, sexually, we want this. On the other hand, they're sucking up to these wealthy, greedy capitalists who are manipulating the economies of the world for their own gain. And they got no problem with that.
You got some passion on that one, too.
You know, there's a little passion there, I think. We have a chance to often rail on political issues.
I mean, it's like anyone that can just give a scant look at history. Does anyone think that the Crusades were a really good idea?
I don't think. Well, there might be some Islamists who do, but
think of what we've inherited that is still the aftermath. We're still dealing with some of the tragic errors that were made a thousand years ago in terms of that dynamic. We're just going like, by the force of the sword, I'm going to convert you to Christ. He's a God of love, you know. You're just going like...
Bit of a disconnect there, isn't it?
That's a unique way of expressing that love. It's pretty ferocious, isn't it?
But when you lose sight of him, I think you get there. Because you look at Christianity now as an agenda to be pursued, rather than a king to follow. And so I'm not surprised that now, you know, we're not in any danger of, I think, resurrecting the Inquisition. We're really not, because no one, I don't know, anybody advocating dragging people, heretics, off into prison and burning them at the stake.
There's a couple guys on radio that might.
Yeah, yeah, well, the radio guys. You know how they are. But the political bent of willing to compel by law what can only be won in the heart, that is an issue.
Yeah, I think that's where there's the tragic mistake, where you're just going, like, you know what? That isn't being salt and light. That is, once again, using, quote, political force
right.
to try to affect change, which is only external. And it's almost as if it creates a deeper resentment. I mean, when you try to force someone to do something against their will, you haven't converted anything. You've basically, I think, reverted them. The moment they have a chance to go back to what they will.
Absolutely. I think any time, I think it's partly because God's made us to be decision makers. And don't we resent when somebody's trying to force us into a decision we haven't chosen?
Yeah.
Yeah. Roger Williams, the first governor of Rhode Island, he called that the rape of the soul. Anytime you try to make somebody do what they otherwise haven't freely chosen to do, particularly in matters of conscience. And he called it the liberty of conscience. He called it when you take over someone's right to choose in terms of their religious faith or belief or not, then he called that the rape of the soul. And he made the same conclusion you did. You don't endear people to your point of view. You actually alienate them.
Yeah.
You actually alienate them from the very thing you want to win them.
And I think some of the and I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. I think the sincere, well-intentioned efforts to, like, you know, we're going to make a stand. We're going to go out there and we're going to confront this issue in the culture. You know, a lot of times there can be some chest thumping and some Bible banging to try to foam up, you know, let's take our stand. I just don't know that message really melts the hearts of those they're taking a stand against. It's like, do we just allow evil to? No. But how are you going to win people over? Is it by my trying to intimidate you? Or is it by my coming alongside you and actually finding a way to have a dialogue where you know you're heard, not just I'm reacting to the ways I've always misinterpreted you and the sound bites of what I think you are talking about? I mean, when you listen to both sides of what's going on, there is so much miscommunication that is just being tossed about in terms of sound bites and how things are typically represented in the media, largely because they have a desire to foment something because they're trying to sell soap.
Absolutely. I've not done a thing with bridge builders that the media has been involved in where the media – one interview I did when I actually called the reporter back and I said, you know, you actually got that right. But most of the instances I go to, we'll go have this wonderful negotiation. We'll vote out a solution 27-2 by the folks that are there, and they're pretty, you know, wide political views coming into the room. And then the media will quote the two people who weren't satisfied in the paper the next day. And I think with the media, you do get accurate points of view. What you don't get from the media is a sense of proportion as to how many people really are feeling that and what kinds of things do happen that are better. And I think there are people involved, for instance, in the anti-abortion thing that really do have a compassion for pregnant girls who are scared and really have provided some wonderful ways to get to. I think that's there, but you don't see it in the media. The media is going to take the people who are screaming with the signs down at the clinic, you know, and all the anger and throwing rocks and, you know, all that stuff. And so the media doesn't give us a good sense of proportion. But I do think what's the most important thing in all our wanting to help society understand a better way to live, what's got to be communicated is the character of Christ, his humility, his compassion. Jesus didn't seem to lift one finger to change the Roman Empire or even change the Jewish social system. He lived something different. He invited other people to live in that difference. But that was not something he did as a political campaign. It wasn't something he did with the power of heaven and earth. It's how he lived, with being able to love the lost and broken and invite them into wholeness. It's very clear what Jesus' morality looked like. He didn't have to fuzz that up to be loving, but he could be clear about it and loving at the same time. And that's what I hunger. If Christian comes to mean that again, then, yeah, when people ask me if I'm Christian on a plane, I'm going to say, absolutely. But if it means all these other things that ignore a greater reality, if it means I am angry about certain sins but ignore my own, I'm not into that.
Yeah. Well, I think any time that you try to put a label on something, it seems to me that Jesus sort of, you know, defies the whole dynamic of just mere labels. It's like any label you do try to put a name. I mean, even the very names of God. When you try to just limit God to just that name, you're going like, but you've missed so much more. Exactly. He isn't just that.
Yeah, yes.
And if that's all you're focusing on, guess what? You've now warped something. You know, I think of Judas, he kind of fascinates me because, you know, I think he gets a tremendous amount of bad press. And I'm not a big proponent of Judas, but of some of the research and study I've done, Judas was a political zealot. He was someone that, you know, I think he was fascinated by Jesus. I think he was excited with what he heard. I think the whole betrayal, I think in a lot of people's minds, I mean, I could be wrong at this because I wasn't there, but the dynamics is I think Judas was trying to force Jesus' hand. I think he knew that this is my king. He's going to bring his kingdom, and I'm going to sort of...
You've been reading that Gospel of Judas, haven't you?
No, I haven't. But you know what? I'm curious about... You know, I think there's some faulty things there, but I think I'm curious of the fact that I don't think Judas was this money-grubbing, I mean, guy that just wanted to betray Jesus, because at the end of his forcing Jesus' hand, you know, giving that kiss, I don't think Judas saw that that was going to lead to Jesus' being crucified. I don't think Judas understood that at all. I think when all of a sudden he recognized that his effort to force Jesus, like, you know, rise up, just get the Romans, and all of a sudden Jesus didn't act that way, and it led to the trial, you're just going like... Judas's response was, I mean, he was so filled with despair and remorse. He took the money he was given, threw it back in the temple, and then hanged himself. That isn't some guy who was out for money.
Felt like it worked. His plan worked. Yeah,
That was the grand oops. You're just going like, you know, it's like sadly he didn't recognize that God could forgive that too. But you do see perhaps, you know, a misdiagnosed reality. I think a lot of people out there have gotten just enough of the truth that they recognize, okay, God's going to transform culture. So now I'm going to help him. I'm going to force the issue. I'm going to draw the lines. And then when Jesus doesn't force people to adopt him and to embrace him, I mean, I look at the transformation in the person of Paul, who is like the Pharisee of Pharisees out there killing Christians. You know, and going out there and bring people back into Judaism. And then you see him later reveling in weakness. And you're just going like, wait a minute. What happened in that dude who was out there by force trying to stamp out something that he determined wasn't the right thing? And then all of a sudden he realized, oh my gosh, I have blundered beyond belief. And then you see what's reflected in the rest of his life. He isn't out there forcing. He is actually reveling in a posture of weakness. And you're just going like, I haven't heard any sermons on that. I really haven't. And you're just going like, our culture doesn't embrace or relish or even, you know, I mean, they abhor weakness.
No, we're as enamored with power, I think, as the world is. One of the things that I blogged from Christianity Today a few issues ago, back in March, I think, it was a funny little article. It was about being in the world and not of the world, but said the way we've done it as Christians, we are actually of the world and no longer in it, which I thought was a great statement.
Wow.
Because we become like them in their lust for power and our use of political things and manipulating situations, and we become so much like them, but now we're no longer with them because they don't want to be anywhere near us.
Yeah.
I think what you've just described, the only way I can think that we can accurately convey that in the world is not through a political agenda, but through a person, through people who mirror that kind of life. And I think that's what troubles me when people who claim the name of Christ, and I don't know that you can get to the level of national politics that some of the people have written about in this essay, without, you know, selling your soul to some degree to the money people that put you there. I don't even know if that's possible. In fact, I'm a little bit more cynical about that than I ever have been. But I think what troubles me most, when people who name the name of Christ, whether they're a TV preacher or a politician, if they don't exude the character of Christ's compassion, humility, and tenderness. And they are brash and arrogant and pushy. I think that's what bothers me most.
Yeah.
I find that people will, as I've been involved with this bridge builder thing for a number of years, one of the things that surprised me most, because I do a lot of, I've done a lot of conference for health education workers here in California, and one of the people that's hired me to do that used to oversee the whole HIV/AIDS prevention curriculum in the state of California. And I did a number of conferences for her, and after one of them that I left, and she knows where I come at. She knows I'm a former minister. She knows I'm conservative in terms of political morality. I do workshop sessions helping health education workers understand why Christians are opposed to homosexuality and how we can handle anti-discrimination without undermining people's religious beliefs about the morality of homosexuality. And I go through all that, and people know where I'm at. And I got in a car with her one day because I needed transportation between two events. And I was going in her car, and she said, well, you can do it as long as we can have a discussion in the car about something. And I said, oh, yeah, that'd be fine. I had no idea what it would be. And I got in the car with her, and she went to put the key in the ignition. She turned to me and said, remember you said we could talk about something on this trip? And I said, absolutely. What would you like to talk about? And she said, I would like to know everything you know about Jesus Christ. And I actually, because this is kind of a lady that...
That's a mind bender.
A bit of a practical joker. So I really thought she was kidding. I just busted out laughing. I went, yeah, right. And she said, I'm serious. And I said, no, you're not. She said, I really am. I said, you're going to have to convince me, because I said, I don't think you're serious at all. Because this is the most liberal person I'd ever known. She's anti-Christian. She's pro-gay rights. She's pro-abortion rights. I mean, she does not fit a profile anywhere close to that. And so I said, you got to tell me why. And she said, I will. She said, when I was 6 years old, I went forward to a Billy Graham crusade and gave my heart to Jesus. She said, I know I was young, but I touched something real then. And she said, my parents and I went to a church until I was 12. And then our congregation went through this horrible split. We ended up spilling out of it. My parents were accused of all kinds of things they didn't do. And we'd never seen any group of people be as angry in a conflict as those Christians were. She said, she's in her 50s. I haven't been back to church since I was a 12-year-old girl. And she said, and then she said this, which I thought was interesting. And every Christian I've ever met has only proved to me I made the right decision.
Oh, wow.
And then she said, until I met you. And I said, really? She said, yeah. She said, I knew you were a minister the first thing you walked into, and I hated you. I was going to give you my get out of here vibes. And she said, but I've watched you the last 5 years. She said, I love what you do. She said, I know you and I disagree politically on just about everything. But she said, I have become convinced of this. If Jesus Christ were alive on the planet today, he'd look a little like Wayne Jacobson. Now, I know that comes as quite a shock to you. It does to Sarah, too. I mean, it's just hilarious. Like, because people know. I'm not anywhere close to that. But I tell you what, that Jesus would allow himself to take shape in me for her, I think that's an amazing deal. She said, I've watched you. She said, I know you're anti-gay rights. And she said, I know you're not for homosexual marriages in the culture. And I know that you think there's a moral issue with homosexuality, but she said, I watch you sit down at lunchtime. I know you know the couple sitting across from you is a gay couple in relationship. I know you know that. I know they know you know that, and that they know you are not supportive of their lifestyle. But she said, I watch the way you treat people and the questions they ask you. I have watched you for 5 years. She said, I'm convinced that you know something about Jesus I don't know. And for 2.5 hours on this trip, we talked about Jesus. And at the end of it, I gave her a copy of He Loves Me as I stepped out of the car. And you say, you know, I don't have time to answer all your questions. I'm at a parking lot to meet someone else that was taking me on to another meeting I need to be at. And I said, let me give you a copy of this if you want to read it. She wrote me about a week later, and she said, Wayne, I want you to know I've read your book. I loved it. I loved our discussion. She said, and I wanted you to know that I began today again the journey I stopped when I was a 12-year-old girl. Now, I think that's amazing in that, yeah, I've got a political agenda that's different than hers, but it's a person. I guess that's what I want. A person
involved. You don't have a political agenda.
I don't.
You have a person.
I'm not wanting to restrict people. I want to see him healed in the life of Jesus. And so, yeah, I think people, I want to tell people, yeah, if you're thinking about being involved in politics, my goodness, we need people on this journey who are in those discussions, who are running for office, working with people who are, but not being voices for this narrow-minded agenda, being demonstrations of the character of Jesus. That's what I want to see.
Well, it just seems that, you know, you can't step into that realm without being sort of ensnared by the whole politics of self-interest. there are groups who are promising you power if you'll pander to them. And you're just going like, gosh, you know, where can we find, quote, a few good men who, and women who will basically go in there saying, you know, my focus is to govern, not just get reelected. I do want to think through, you know, not just what's the benefit for me and my little group, but what's the betterment of all? I mean, that kind of government would be helpful. Wow, but that's not what we got going on.
That's idealistic.
Yeah, yeah. I'll have to buy an island and set that up and then see if I can even be a part of it.
I used to hope that was true of our national leaders. You know, I really did. And I don't know if it's our generation that's ruined it, like we've ruined everything else. We seem to have ruined sports. We seem to have ruined everything.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
I'm sorry. We just seem to have. And but I tell you, I am less and less. I think the person that goes to Washington, for instance, with the real heart to just be effective and be compassionate and look for the common ground, I don't think they can raise enough funds, get their names on enough bill. I think they'll be gone the next term. And that's the kind of government we have now. There is no sense of the common good. There's a sense of choosing sides, vilifying the enemy, getting as much power and money as I can get so that I can retain my power. And I do hope and pray. I don't care if they go and they're one-termers. I think that prophetic voice and life in the midst of our culture is a good thing. So people listening to this, yeah, run for school board. Run for city council. Be involved in the process, but don't sell out to your own political gain. Sell out to a kingdom that finds as much joy in powerlessness as it finds in power, and maybe more. And doing what we do out of the character of Christ, and being not taking the term Christian to us, but letting someone else give it to us when they think they look like a little Christ in the world.
Yeah, you know, it's not just how to live this life in the realm of politics. I mean, I think of my kids, it's the same way to live this thing on the playground. You got power struggles at all levels, you know, whether it's preschool, elementary school, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
The challenge, yeah, I was having a conversation with Jared, and he was going like, Dad, it just seems like those that want to exert their will seem to get their way. And
they do.
And I responded, I said, I know. I said, that can be really discouraging or frustrating. I said, because I don't have the internal permission to act that way. It's like, if that's what I have to do to get my way, that doesn't seem right. And he says, I know, Dad, I feel that too. And you just go like, you know, the challenge is to have a trust and a belief that, you know what, as weak, as powerless as it sometimes feel, I do not have to exert to my arm of flesh in order to see this kingdom made manifest. And it's like, you can either trust that God is going to reveal himself, or you can try to do it for him, which may end up in a real mess.
Absolutely.
You want to end with a mind-bender question that I know is burning on both our hearts, is if you ask Jesus if he was a Christian,
what would he say? You want to go there? Don't think he was.
I think a bunch of cows, a whole herd just fell right over right there.
I can't
there.
Believe you would invoke that here.
I know, but
it's an interesting question.
But that is it. When you think of it, it's like, you know, are you a Christian? Well, you know, it's like, I think most of us have a bent saying, well, you know, of course. It's like, yeah. And it's like, but if you were to ask the one that we're following, are you a Christian? Pretty sure he wouldn't say yes.
I kind of wonder how many people we've ticked off today in this one little podcast.
Use your arm of force to get us.
No, you don't have to do that. I do. One of the encouraging things I think with bridge builders and building the common ground in districts I've been to, I've been in rooms, 30 people in it, 15 conservative Christians having all that, maybe 15 of them gay rights advocates who are negotiating a sexual orientation issue. And they don't believe me when I say we'll walk out of the room tonight when 90% of us agree on a policy. But when that room discovers that it's not about winning my agenda over your agenda, but how do we be fair to the differences in the room? Very quickly, I'm encouraged by the fact that I can promise 80 to 90% of people will sign on to policies that are not based in my preference over your preference, but based on, can we ask government to be fair to our differences rather than siding with one of us or the other? And so I am encouraged. There are things that can be done. Unfortunately, there's not too many power structures that are really looking for the common ground or the common good. No. Most of them are looking for their own gain. And that's the world we live in. Thank God our kingdom is not of this world. And so we can live in him every day and have the influence he wants us to have without trying to change the world and make it in our image.
Well said.
And that's a gift.
Thanks for traveling with us today on The God Journey. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd appreciate your comments or your questions by email or at our website, thegodjourney.com. Stop by today and join the conversation.